Chapter 31. The tram moved slowly out of the station, passing another tram going in the opposite direction. Though it picked up speed until it was gliding over the rails at nearly 30 miles an hour, Pitt felt as if the tram were crawling, and he wanted to get out and help push it. Stations designated in the letters of the alphabet came and went, each one met with their expectation of security guards flooding on board and seizing them. When the tram exchanged passengers at W station, Pitt's hopes began to rise. But at X station, their luck ran out. 6 black-uniformed security guards boarded the end car and began checking the passengers' identification tags, which Pitt only now observed were carried on bracelets around their wrists. He cursed himself for not knowing earlier that he could have stolen the bracelets from the furniture movers. Too late, it occurred to him that the guards would make a special effort to search for people without them. He also noted that they seemed to be taking extra time to check any workers wearing red or yellow coveralls. "They're working their way closer," Giordino noted without emotion, as the guards entered the second car of the 5-car tram. "One at a time," said Pitt. "Move casually to the first car." Without a word passing between them, Giordino went first, followed by Megan and then Pat, with Pitt bringing up the rear. "We might make the next station before they reach this car," said Giordino, "but it's going to be close." "I doubt if we'll get off that easy," Pitt said grimly. "They'll probably be waiting there too." He walked forward and peered through the window of the door leading to a small control cab in the front of the car. There was a console with lights, buttons, and switches, but no driver or engineer. The tram was fully automatic. He tried the door latch, but wasn't surprised to find it locked. He studied the symbols and markings on the console panel. One in particular struck his eye. Gripping the Colt, he rapped the barrel against the glass window and shattered it. Ignoring the startled looks of the car's passengers, he reached inside and unlocked the door. Without the slightest pause, he reached out and moved the first of 5 toggle switches connected to the tram's electronic couplings. Next, he reset the computer that actuated the speed of the tram. The desired effect gave him a surge of pleasure. The 4 rear cars detached from the lead car and began to fall back. Though each car had its own power source, their preset speed was now slower than that of the forward car. The security guards could only contact other search teams and watch helplessly as the distances between the cars rapidly widened and their quarry gained a growing lead. 4 minutes later, the car with Pitt and the others swept past Y station without stopping, to the frustration of a team of security guards and the dumb expressions of the workers who stood on the platform. Pitt felt as if his stomach were being squeezed by a cold hand, and his mouth felt as though it were stuffed with dry leaves. He was playing a desperate gamble, with the dice loaded against him. He glanced behind him into the car and caught sight of Pat, sitting with an arm around Megan's shoulder, one arm still clutching the attaché case, her face pale and strangely sad and forlorn. He walked back and ran his hand through her streaming red hair. "We'll get through this," he said, with an air of conviction. "Old Dirk will take you over the water and the mountains." She looked up and managed a faint smile. "Is that a guarantee?" "Ironclad," he said, with a growing conviction inside him. 1/2 minute passed. Pitt walked back into the control cabin and saw that they were approaching the marina at the stern of the ship. Up ahead, he could see the tracks begin their curve toward the marina, where the tram, he was certain, was supposed to stop at Z station before continuing around the ship. He didn't need mystical powers to know security guards had reached the station platform first and were waiting to blast them with an arsenal of weapons. "I'm going to slow the car to about 10 miles an hour," Pitt said. "When I give the word, we jump. The edge of the tracks is planted with vegetation, so our landing should be fairly soft. Try to roll forward when you hit. At this point, we can't afford to have anybody suffer a fractured ankle or leg. Giordino put his arm around Megan. We'll go together. That way you'll have lots of fat to cushion your fall. It was a broad misstatement. Giordino didn't have an ounce of fat on his muscular body. Pitt reset the controls and the car slowed abruptly. The instant the red numbers on the speed scale dropped to 10 miles an hour, he yelled, "All right, everyone out." He hesitated, making sure they all had leaped from the tram. Then he punched up the numbers until the dial read 60 miles an hour, before running from the cab to the door and jumping as the tram car quickly accelerated toward its fastest speed. He struck soft earth feet first before rolling with the momentum of a cannonball into a bed of ornamental bonsai trees, crushing their distorted branches and mashing them into the soil with his weight. He staggered to his feet. One knee protested in pain, but he was still capable of active movement. Giordino was beside him, helping him regain his balance. He was relieved to see Pat and Megan, their faces clear of expressions of pain. They seemed more concerned with brushing the soil and pine needles from their hair. The tram had disappeared around the bend, but the stairway leading to the first pier was no more than 50 feet away, and no guards were nearby. "Where are we going?" Pat asked, regaining a small measure of composure. "Before we catch our plane," answered Pitt, "we have to take a little boat trip." He caught her by the arm and dragged her behind him as Giordino hustled Megan along. They ran along the track until they reached the stairs leading down to Pier Number 1. As Pitt suspected, the security guards had encircled the station at Z Section 200 yards farther up the track in the center of the marina. Confusion reigned as the tram car shot past the station and around the next bend on its way along the port side of the ship. The guards, completely deluded into thinking their prey was still hiding in the speeding car, hurriedly launched a pursuit, as the security director in command ordered the power circuits for the tram system to be closed down. Pitt figured it would take them another 7 minutes before the guards could reach the stopped car and realize that it was empty. If he and the others weren't off the ship by then, capture was a foregone conclusion. None of the workers on the pier paid any attention to them as they calmly strolled down the steps and onto the pier. There were 3 boats moored between the first and second piers, a small 24-foot sailboat, a vessel that Pitt recognized as a 42-foot Grand Banks cabin cruiser, and a 24-foot classic runabout. "Climb aboard the big powerboat," said Pitt, walking placidly across the pier. "I guess we're not going to retrieve our dive gear," said Giordino. Pat and Megan could never make it back alive in the water. Better we take our chances on the surface. "The runabout is faster," Giordino pointed out. "True," Pitt agreed, "but the security force will be suspicious of a fast boat speeding away from the shipyard. The Grand Banks powerboat, cruising calmly across the water, won't create near the attention." There was a dockhand hosing down the deck when Pitt walked up and stopped at the gangway. "Nice boat," he said, smiling. "Hey?" The dockhand looked at him, unable to understand English. Pitt moved up the gangway and gestured at the no-nonsense lines of the Grand Banks 42. "She's a nice boat," he repeated, boldly stepping into the bridge cabin. The dockhand followed him inside, protesting his trespass on the boat. But once they were out of sight of other workers on the pier, Pitt lashed out with his fist and decked him with a solid blow to the jaw. Then he leaned out the doorway and announced, "I'll cast off the lines. You ladies all aboard." Pitt stood for a moment and studied the instruments on the console. He turned the key and hit the twin starter buttons. Down below in the engine compartment, a pair of big marine diesel engines turned over, the fuel inside their firing chambers compressing and igniting to the tune of high-pitched clacking. He slid open the starboard window and peered out. Giordino had untied the fore and aft lines and was climbing on board. Pitt engaged the reverse drive and very slowly began edging the boat away from the pier and backing it toward the open water 20 yards astern. He passed 2 dock workers installing a railing around the pier and waved. They waved back. It's so much easier to be sneaky, he thought, than to burst out of the corral like a wild bull. The boat passed the end of the pier into open water. Now the stern of the great ship soared above them. Pitt moved the shift lever into forward and steered the Grand Banks on a course along the Ulrich Wolf. To reach the fjord and escape the shipyard, they had to cruise entirely around the floating Titan. Pitt set the throttles until the speed instruments read 8 knots, a pace that he hoped would not arouse suspicions. So far there had been no shouts, no bells or whistles, no signs of a chase or searchlights pinning them against the dark water. At this speed it would take 15 minutes to pass the entire length of the supership and turn the bow until they could move a safe distance away and out from under the glare of the lights from the shipyard. 15 agonizing minutes that would seem like 15 years. That was only the first hurdle. They still had the patrol boats to contend with, and by then there was every possibility their crews would have been alerted to the fugitives' escape in the Grand Banks cabin cruiser. There was nothing they could do except remain inside the main cabin out of sight and stare up at the immense monster as they crept alongside. From bow to stern, the great mass of glass was a blaze of light inside and out, giving it the effect of a baseball stadium during a night game. The famous classic liners of their time, Titanic, Lusitania, Queen Mary, Queen Elizabeth, and Normandy, if anchored in a row, would still have come up short next to the Ulrich Wolf. "I could use a hamburger about now," said Giordino, trying to relieve the tension. "Me too," said Megan. "All they fed us was yucky nutritional stuff." Pat smiled, though her face looked strained. "It won't be long, honey, and you'll get your hamburger." Pitt turned from the helm. "Were you treated badly?" "No abuse," answered Pat. "But I've never been ordered around by so many nasty and arrogant people. They worked me 20 hours a day." "Deciphering Amini's inscriptions from another chamber?" "They weren't from another chamber. They were photos taken of inscriptions they found at a lost city in the Antarctic." Pitt looked at her curiously. "The Antarctic?" She nodded solemnly. "Frozen in the ice. The Nazis discovered it before the war." "Elsie Wolf told me they'd found evidence the Aminis built 6 chambers. "I can't say," admitted Pat. "All I can tell you is that I got the impression they're using the ice city for some purpose. What? I didn't find out." "Did you learn anything new from the inscriptions they forced you to decipher?" As she talked, Pat no longer looked sad and forlorn. "I was barely into the project when you burst through the door. They were extremely interested in what we deciphered in the Colorado and St. Paul chambers. It appeared that the Wolves were desperate to study the accounts passed down by the Aminis describing the effects of the cataclysm." "That's because any inscriptions they found inside the lost city came before the cataclysm." He paused and nodded toward her briefcase. "Is that what's in there?" She held it up. "The photos from the Antarctic chamber. I couldn't bring myself to leave them behind." He looked at her steadily. "They don't make women like you anymore." Pitt might have said more, but a boat was crossing his bow about 100 yards ahead. It looked to be a work boat, and its course remained steady as it turned and passed on the Grand Banks port side. The crew seemed intent on their labors and didn't pay the slightest attention to the cabin cruiser. Relaxing a bit as they neared the forward section of the Ulrich Wolf without any sign of pursuit, Pitt asked, "You said they're studying what conditions will be like in the aftermath of the cataclysm?"
"In a big way. I assume they want every bit of data they can glean for their survival."
I'm still at a loss as to why the Wolfs are so positive a comet is going to return and collide with Earth within days of the prediction made by the Amenis 9,000 years ago, Pitt said. Pat shook her head slowly.
I have no answers to that.
Still crawling along at 8 knots, Pitt gently turned the wheel, sending the Grand Banks on a wide arc around the bow of the Ulrich Wolf and passing the end of the dock, now swarming with shipyard workers and security guards checking the identification of every man and woman in red coveralls. He passed a small powerboat running with no lights that ominously swung around in a 180-degree turn and began following in their wake. He set his directional computer on the frame of the windshield and studied the readings that would lead him through the darkness to the ravine that held the skycar. 3 miles to the ravine. 3 miles over water in a boat that offered no protection from probing lights or automatic weapons and heavy machine guns. All they carried were a pair of handguns. And there were the patrol boats that surely must have been alerted by now of a stolen powerboat carrying intruders attempting to escape the shipyard. His only consolation was that the patrol boats were at the far end of the fjord, giving them an extra few minutes of time. A slim consolation at best. With their superior speed, the patrol boats could easily intercept the Grand Banks before they could reach the mouth of the ravine. Al. Giordino was at his side immediately.
Aye, aye.
Find some bottles. There must be some on board. Empty, then fill them with whatever you can find that's highly inflammable. Diesel fuel is too slow burning. Look for gas or solvent.
Molotov cocktails,
said Giordino, grinning like a demon. I haven't thrown one of those since kindergarten. 2 steps, and he was dropping down a ladder to the engine compartment. Pitt brushed aside an urge to shove the throttles to their stops, judging that it was more productive to play out a passive role. He stared over one shoulder at the 25-foot runabout behind them, its big, powerful outboard motor clamped to its transom. It had increased speed and was drawing alongside. The lights from the shipyard revealed only 2 men in black uniforms, one steering the boat, the other standing in the stern gripping an automatic rifle. The one at the helm was motioning at his ear. Pitt understood the message and turned on the radio, leaving it on the frequency it was set. A voice crackled over the speaker in Spanish, with an indisputable inflection that Pitt knew was a command to lay to. He picked up the microphone and answered,
No hable español.
Alto, alto, the voice shouted. Get down below and lay flat on the deck, he ordered Pat and Megan. They silently complied and hurried down the ladder to the main cabin. Pitt slowed the boat and stood in the doorway, his Colt cocked and stuffed under his belt. The guard in the stern of the runabout crouched in readiness to jump on board the Grand Banks. Pitt then pulled back the throttles but kept a slight headway, measuring the distance between the 2 boats and moving at just enough parallel speed so that the boarder would come over the railing almost in line with the doorway to the bridge. His timing would have to be exactly on the mark. He waited patiently, like a hunter in a blind watching the skies for a passing duck. At the precise moment the security guard crouched to leap between the 2 boats, he shoved the twin throttles forward in a brief burst of speed, before abruptly pulling them back again. The sudden movement threw off the balance of the guard, and he landed sprawling on the narrow port deck of the Grand Banks. Pitt smoothly stepped through the cabin door, jammed the heel of his right foot into the guard's neck, bent down and snatched up his automatic rifle, a Bushmaster M17S, and clubbed him behind the neck with the butt end. He leveled it at the guard at the helm of the outboard and fired. He missed as the guard dropped to his knees, cramped the wheel over, hit the throttle, and turned the outboard on a sharp angle away from the Grand Banks. With a loud roar from the motor, the boat leaped away in a cloud of spray and churning water. Without waiting to see more, Pitt stepped back into the cabin and pushed the throttles as far as they would go. The stern of the Grand Banks dug down in the water, the bow lifted, and soon it was rushing across the black waters at nearly 20 knots. Now Pitt focused on the patrol boats that had swung around on a course back up the fjord, coming at full speed, the searchlights playing the water in ever closer sweeps toward the Grand Banks. It was a given that the guard driving the outboard had radioed a report. The lead boat was a good half mile ahead of its escort. From Pitt's view through the windshield, it was impossible to predict when the nearest patrol boat would meet the Grand Banks on a converging course. The only certainty was that it would cross his bows before they reached the mouth of the ravine. Another 6 or 7 minutes would spell the difference between survival and death. They were well clear of the shipyard now, with less than 2 miles to go. The outboard cruiser was less than 100 yards off and slightly behind. The only reason the remaining security guard had not opened up with his own Bushmaster rifle was that he was afraid of hitting his partner. Giordino returned to the cabin, carrying an armload of 4 bottles filled with solvent from a can used to clean oil and grease within the engine compartment. Thin strips of rags were stuffed in the bottlenecks. He carefully set the bottles on the cushions of a bench. The beefy Italian was nursing a large bruise on his forehead. "What happened to you?" Pitt asked. "Some guy I know can't drive a boat. I was thrown all over the engine compartment and bounced my head off a water pipe during a series of wild gyrations." Then Giordino spotted the unconscious body of the security guard lying partially in the door. "My sincerest apologies. You had a social caller." He failed to produce an invitation. Giordino moved beside Pitt and stared through the windshield at the rapidly approaching patrol boat. "No warning shot across the bow with this crew. They're armed to the teeth and looking for any excuse to blow us out of the water."
"Maybe not," said Pitt.
"They still need the expertise of Pat to decipher their inscriptions. They might rough her up and slap Megan around, but they won't kill them. You and I will be history. I plan on giving them a bit of a surprise. If we can suck them in close enough, we might give them a bonfire to enjoy." Giordino stared Pitt in the eyes. Most men would have reflected inevitable defeat, but Giordino saw no such reflection. What he saw was calculated determination and a faint gleam of anticipation. "I wonder how John Paul Jones would see it." Pitt nodded. "You'll be busy with your toys. Lend me your piece. Then lay low on the far side of the bridge until you hear shooting."
"You or them?"
Pitt gave Giordino a dour look.
"It doesn't matter who."
Giordino handed over his para-ordnance automatic without question. As Pitt pushed against the throttles in a fruitless attempt to goad the engines out of a few more revolutions. The Grand Banks was giving everything it had, but it was a boat built for comfortable cruising, not speed. The commander of the patrol boat had no reservations about closing in on the Grand Banks. He had no reason to believe that anyone on board was crazy enough to take on a boat armed with twin machine guns, plus the weapons held by men who were trained to kill at the slightest provocation. He studied the Grand Banks through night glasses, saw only one man standing at the helm on the bridge, and made the ultimate mistake of an aggressor. He profoundly underestimated his adversary. The searchlights were trained on the Grand Banks, illuminating the boat in a blinding glare. The bone of foam cut by the bow fell away as the 38-foot patrol boat edged closer to the Grand Banks and gradually pulled alongside, until it was less than 20 feet away. From his position on the bridge, Pitt squinted his eyes against the bright light and made out a man behind each machine gun, pointing the barrels directly at him in the bridge cabin. 3 other men stood shoulder to shoulder on the open deck aft of the cabin, armed with Bushmaster automatic rifles. Pitt was unable to see Giordino crouched on the opposite side of the cabin, but he knew that his friend was poised with either a match or a lighter to ignite the wicks on the bottles filled with the solvent. It was a nerve-prickling moment, but not one of total hopelessness, certainly not in Pitt's mind. He had no burning desire to execute anyone, not even the species of hardened killers he was looking at across the water, and whose mercenary comrades he'd met in Colorado. It was no mystery that his life and that of Giordino weren't worth 2 cents if they were captured. He watched as the commander of the patrol boat raised a loudspeaker to his mouth. Pitt recognized that the word alto meant stop, and he could only assume the words that followed were a threat, that if he didn't do what he was ordered, the security guards would open fire. He waved that he understood, took one more look at the distance separating him from the ravine, now down to less than half a mile, and a quick glance at the second patrol boat to estimate when it would arrive to back up its escort. 5 to 6 minutes. Next, he checked to make sure the 2 automatics were snug under the belt behind his back. Only then did he pull back the throttles to the idle position. But he kept the boat in gear so that it still maintained very slow headway. He moved to the doorway of the cabin, no farther, raised his hands, and stood properly subdued in the dazzling beam of the light. He didn't bother using his limited Spanish vocabulary. He shouted back in English. "What do you want?" "Do not resist," ordered the commander, now close enough to dispense with the loudspeaker. "I am sending men to board you." "How can I possibly resist?" Pitt offered helplessly. "I have no machine guns like you." "Tell the others to come on deck." Pitt kept his hands in the air, turned, and made as if he were relaying the commander's orders. "They are afraid you will shoot them." "We are not going to shoot anyone," the commander answered, in a tone that was about as slimy as an eel. "Please turn the light out," Pitt begged. "You are blinding me and frightening the women." "Stand where you are and do not move," the commander shouted in exasperation. In a few moments, the patrol boat slowed its engines to a slow throb and angled toward the Grand Banks. A few feet away, 2 of the guards laid down their rifles and began dropping bumpers over the rail of the patrol boat. It was the opportunity Pitt had been waiting for. Even the men behind the machine guns had relaxed. Sensing no sign of trouble, one lit a cigarette. The crew and their commander, their wariness sharply diminished at seeing not the slightest hint of a threat, felt they had the situation firmly under their control. Their attitude was exactly what Pitt had hoped for. Coldly, precisely, he dropped his hands, whipped out the 2 automatics, aimed the one in his right hand at the man standing at the forward machine gun, and in the same moment in time lined up the left muzzle at the gunner in the stern, pulling both triggers as fast as his fingers could curl. At a range of 15 feet, he couldn't miss. The machine gunner in the bow sank to his knees on the deck with a bullet in his shoulder. The gunner in the stern threw his hands in the air, stumbled backward, and fell over the gunwale into the water. Almost simultaneously, flaming bottles of fuel soared over and past the Grand Banks bridge like a meteor shower and dropped onto the cabin and decks of the patrol boat, erupting in a roar of flames as the glass shattered and the contents ignited. The fiery liquid pooled and spread across the patrol boat, turning it into a blazing funeral pyre. Virtually, the whole open stern deck and half the cabin erupted into flame. Tongues of fire soon poked from every port. Finding themselves about to burn alive, the crew unhesitatingly hurled their bodies into the cold water. The wounded gunner on the bow also staggered across the deck through the flames and leaped overboard. His clothing afire, the commander ignored the flames and stared scathingly at Pitt before shaking his fist and leaping over the side. "Truculent jerk," Pitt thought. He didn't waste so much as a second. He rushed to the bridge console and thrust the throttles full forward again, sending the Grand Banks on its interrupted journey toward the ravine. Only then did he spare the time to turn and stare at the patrol boat. The entire craft was engulfed with contorted flames that danced high into the night sky. Black smoke curled and twisted upward, blotting out the stars. In another minute, the fuel tanks exploded, throwing burning debris into the air like a fireworks display. She began to sink by the stern, sliding backward with a hissing sound as the icy water met the blistering flames. Then, with a great sigh, as if she had a soul, the patrol boat sank out of sight. Giordino came around the cabin and stood at the door, looking at the bits and pieces of burning debris and oil that floated on the surface.
"Nice shooting," he said quietly.
"Good pitching."
Giordino inclined his head toward the second patrol boat that was hurtling across the fjord. Then he turned slightly and stared toward the shore.
"It's going to be close," he said objectively. "They won't fall for a sucker play like their buddies. They'll stand off at a safe distance and try and disable us by shooting at our engines."
"Pat and Megan are down there," Giordino reminded him.
"Bring them up," said Pitt, his eyes reading the numbers on the directional computer.
He made a slight adjustment and swung the Grand Banks another 5 degrees to the southwest. 400 yards remained. The gap was rapidly narrowing.
"Tell them to get ready to abandon the boat the instant we hit shore."
"You're going to hit the rocks at full throttle?"
"We don't have time to tie up to a rock and step ashore with confetti and bands playing."
"On my way," Giordino acknowledged with a brief wave.
The second patrol boat was driving directly toward them, unaware of Pitt's intention to run ashore. The searchlight illuminated the Grand Banks in its beam with unwavering steadiness, like a spotlight trained at a dancer on a stage. The two boats closed rapidly, running at an angle toward each other. Then the commander of the patrol boat sensed Pitt's intentions and steered to cut off the Grand Banks and block it from reaching the shore. With less than half the speed of his nemesis, Pitt was forced to accept the fact that he was engaged in a race he would surely lose. Yet he stood at the helm with unblinking eyes and a callous determination. The fight was extremely one-sided, but he wasn't about to turn the other cheek. The thought of failure never entered his mind. Seeing an unexpected opportunity, Pitt yanked the gear lever and threw the Grand Banks into reverse. The boat shuddered from the strain under full throttle and came to a stop, its props beating the water in a maelstrom of froth. Then it began moving backward, its square transom pushing aside the water like a bulldozer. Giordino appeared with Pat and Megan. He stared, bemused, at seeing the patrol boat about to cross the Grand Banks' bow while their own boat was surging backward.
"Don't tell me. I'm keen to guess. You've conjured up another cunning plan."
"Not cunning, just desperate."
"You're going to ram him."
"If we play our cards right," answered Pitt quickly, "I do believe we can bloody his nose. Now, everyone lie on the floor. Use whatever solid cover you can find to shield yourselves, because it's surely going to rain." There was no time to say more. The commander of the second patrol boat, not comprehending the reverse movement of his prey, altered his course so that he would cross within 10 feet of the Grand Banks bow, come to a stop, and blast the Grand Banks at point-blank range. It was a naval tactic called crossing the T. He stood at the helm and raised one hand as a signal for the gunners to open fire. Then two events happened in the same instant. Pitt crammed the gear lever back to full forward, and the machine guns on the patrol boat opened up. The Grand Banks props dug in the water and sent the boat surging forward as bullets sprayed the bridge. The glass from the windshield shattered into 1,000 shards and burst all through the cabin. Pitt had already thrown himself down behind the console, one hand raised and gripping the bottom arc of the helm. He didn't notice that the back of his hand had been gashed by flying glass until the blood began dripping into his eyes. The upper cabin of the Grand Banks was being methodically shot to pieces. The gunners were shooting high to throw sheer terror into the minds of those lying prone on the deck. The interior of the bridge was a bedlam of flying wreckage, as 9mm shells shredded everything they smashed against. The commander of the patrol boat had cut his speed and was drifting to a stop, since his gunners seemed to be enjoying close-up target practice. His satisfaction was premature, while Pitt's timing couldn't have been more perfect. The commander missed Pitt's intent until it was too late. Before he could steer his patrol boat out of the way, the Grand Banks had suddenly jerked forward, her engines pounding at full RPMs. There came a grinding sound of twisted and tortured fiberglass and wood. The Grand Banks' bow sliced through the starboard hull of the patrol boat and punched through to the keel.
The patrol boat canted over on her port side, the crew grabbing at any solid object to keep from being pitched overboard, and began to settle almost immediately. Pitt hauled himself to his feet, threw the gear lever into reverse, and backed the Grand Banks out of the gash in the hull of the patrol boat, allowing a rush of water to flood and gurgle into the cavity. For a moment, the patrol boat struggled back to an even keel. But then the black waters flowed over her deck, and she slipped away, her searchlight still glaring as it plunged to the floor of the fjord, leaving her crew struggling to stay afloat in the frigid waters.
"Al," Pitt said in a conversational tone, "check the forward compartment."
Giordino disappeared through a hatch and returned in seconds. "We're sucking in water like a giant douchebag. Another 5 minutes and we'll join our friends in the water, even faster if you don't stop this tub."
"Who said anything about going forward?"
Pitt's eyes locked on the direction computer. The distance to shore and the mouth of the ravine was only 50 yards, but it was an impossible span for a fast-sinking boat. Trying to move ahead would only escalate the flood of water pouring in through the shattered bow. His mind raced with a strange clarity, as it always did during crisis, considering any and every option. He sent the Grand Banks barreling through the water in reverse, which lowered the stern and raised the bow. The flooding problem temporarily solved, he warned the others. "Get out on deck and brace yourselves for the shock when we strike the rocks."
"On deck?" Pat asked numbly.
"In case the boat rolls over when we ground, you're better off out in the open where you can jump in the water." None too soon, Giordino herded the two females outside and made them sit down on the deck, backs against the cabin while reaching out and clutching the railing. He sat in the middle with both strong arms encircling their waists. Pat was frozen in pure fright, but Megan, looking into Giordino's unperturbed face, took courage from it. He and the man at the helm had brought them this far. It was utterly incomprehensible to her that they wouldn't make good on their word and take her safely home. The Grand Banks was settling lower from the water coming through the damaged hull below the waterline aft of the bow. The mouth of the ravine was very close now. Black heaps of rock that Pitt and Giordino had waded past, before commencing their underwater journey to the shipyard earlier that night, rose from the blackness, ominous and beckoning. Pitt did his best to dodge around the largest of the rocks, barely distinguishing their shapes, as they were outlined by the white foam of the fjord's 2-foot waves that slapped against them. And then one of the propellers struck with a loud metallic smack and sheared off, sending the engine racing out of control. More rocks swirled by. Then came a heavier blow and the boat shuddered but kept going several more feet, before the port side of the transom crunched into a rock that smashed the yielding wood to pieces. As though a dam had burst, a gush of water flooded across the rear open deck, pulling down the stern. The next shock came with bone-jarring impact, as the boat struck hard on and split down the keel, the wooden-planked hull tearing itself to pieces. But then the terrible crunching and grinding sounds ceased, as the battered Grand Banks finally came to a stop, with only 10 feet separating her ruptured stern from the edge of the rocky shoreline. Pitt snatched up the little directional computer and rushed out the bridge door. "Everybody ashore who's going ashore," he shouted. He snatched up Megan under one arm and smiled at her. "Sorry about this, young lady, but we can't hang around to find a ladder." Then he slid over the railing and lowered himself and Megan into the frigid water, his feet touching bottom in 4 feet. He knew Pat and Giordino were right behind him, as he struggled over the rocky bottom and slime-covered rocks toward dry land. As soon as his feet cleared the water, he released Megan and checked his directional computer to make absolutely certain they had the right ravine. They did. The sky car was only minutes away.
"You're hurt," said Pat,
seeing the dark stream of blood on his hand under the light of the stars and falling crescent moon.
"You've got a nasty gash."
"A glass cut," he said simply. She inserted a hand under her red coveralls, ripped off her bra, and began using it to wrap Pitt's hand to stem the flow of blood.
"Now there's a bandage I've never seen before," he murmured with a grin.
"Under the circumstances," she said, tying the ends tightly in a knot, "it's the best I can do."
"Who's complaining?"
He gave her a hug and then turned to the shadow that was Giordino.
"All present and accounted for?"
Giordino had Megan by the hand.
"Adrenaline still pumping."
"Then come on," said Pitt. "Our private plane awaits."
To Sandecker and Agent Little, the wait for the next contact from Pitt and Giordino seemed interminable. The fire had died to a few smoldering embers, and the Admiral seemed to have no interest in rekindling it. He puffed on one of his big cigars, covering the ceiling with a haze of blue smoke. Both he and Little passed the time sitting spellbound, listening to the tales told by Admiral Hosefell, tales he had never told anyone in more than 56 years.
"You were saying, Admiral," said Sandecker, "that the Nazis sent expeditions to explore Antarctica several years before the war."
"Yes, Adolf Hitler was far more creative than people thought. I can't say what inspired him, but he acquired a fascination for Antarctica, primarily to populate and to use as a giant military establishment. He believed that if such a dream came true, his naval and air forces could control all the seas south of the Tropic of Capricorn. Captain Alfred Richer was put in command of a large expedition to explore the subcontinent. The Schwabenland, an early German aircraft carrier used to refuel seaplanes flying the Atlantic in the early 1930s, was converted for Antarctic exploration, and left Hamburg in December of 1938 under the pretense of studying the feasibility of setting up a whaling colony. After reaching their destination in the middle of the southern summer, Richer sent out aircraft with the newest and best German cameras. His flyers covered over 250,000 square miles and took more than 11,000 aerial photographs.
"I have heard rumors of such an expedition," said Sandecker, "but until now I never learned the true facts."
Richer returned with a larger expedition a year later, this time with improved aircraft with skis, so they could land on the ice. They also brought along a small Zeppelin. This time they covered 350,000 square miles, landing at the South Pole and dropping flags with the swastika emblem every 30 miles as markers for their claim of Nazi territory.
"Did they discover anything of unusual interest?" asked Little.
"Indeed they did," replied Hosefell. "The aerial surveys recorded a number of ice-free areas, frozen lakes whose ice surface was less than 4 feet thick, and steam vents with signs of vegetation growing nearby. Their photographs also detected what looked like bits and pieces of roads under the ice." Sandecker sat up straight and gazed at the old German U-boat commander. "The Germans found evidence of a civilization on Antarctica?"
Hosefell nodded.
"Teams using motorized snow vehicles found natural ice caves. While exploring them, they stumbled onto the remains of an ancient civilization. This discovery inspired the Nazis to use their engineering and technical ingenuity to build a vast underground base in Antarctica. It was the best-kept secret of the war."
"To my knowledge," said Little, "Allied intelligence sources ignored rumors of a Nazi base in Antarctica. They considered them far-fetched propaganda."
Hosefell gave a crooked smile.
"They were meant to.
But once Admiral Dönitz nearly gave it away. During a speech to his U-boat commanders, he announced, 'The German submarine fleet is proud of having built for the Führer, in another part of the world, a Shangri-La on land, an impregnable fortress.' Fortunately for us, nobody paid attention. The U-boats I commanded earlier in the war were never sent to the Antarctic, so it wasn't until near the end, when I became commander of the U-699, that I learned of the secret base, whose code name was New Berlin."
"How was it built?"
inquired Sandecker.
After the war began, the first step the Nazis took was to send a pair of raiders into the southern waters to sink all hostile shipping and keep the Allies from obtaining any information concerning the project. Until they were eventually sunk by ships of the British Navy, the raiders had captured or destroyed entire fleets of Allied shipping and all fishing and whaling ships that strayed into the area. Next, an armada of cargo ships, disguised as Allied merchant vessels, and a fleet of huge U-boats, built not for warfare but to transport large cargoes, began moving men, equipment, and supplies to the area of the ancient civilization they thought might be Atlantis.
"Why build a base on ancient ruins?" said Little. "What military purpose did it serve?"
The dead and lost city itself was not important. It was the vast ice cave they found under a field of ice that led from the city. The cave traveled 25 miles, before ending at a geothermal lake that covered 110 square miles. Scientists, engineers, construction teams, and every arm of the military, Army, Air Force, Navy, and of course a large contingent of SS to maintain security and oversee the operation, landed and began an immense excavation project. They also imported a large army of slave labor, mostly captured Russians from Siberia, who had built up a resistance to cold climates.
"What happened to the Russian prisoners after the base was completed?" asked Little, suspecting the answer.
Ozefell's face turned grim. The Nazis could never allow them to be released and reveal Germany's best-kept secret. They were either worked to death or executed.
Sandecker studied the smoke spiraling from his cigar soberly. "So, thousands of Russians lie under the ice, unknown and forgotten."
"Life was cheap to the Nazis," said Hosefell. "The sacrifice to build a fortress to launch the Fourth Reich was well worth the price to them."
"The Fourth Empire," Sandecker said darkly. "The last Nazi bastion and their final attempt at world domination."
"Germans are a very obstinate race."
"Did you see this base?" asked Little.
Again, Hosefell nodded. "After leaving Bergen, Captain Harger and the U-2015, followed by my crew in the U-699, sailed across the Atlantic without surfacing, to a deserted port in Patagonia."
"Where you offloaded your passengers and treasures," added Sandecker.
"You are familiar with the operation?"
"Only the basics, not the details."
"Then you couldn't know that only the passengers and medical specimens went ashore. The art treasures, hoards of gold and other valuables, as well as the sacred Nazi relics, remained on board the U-2015 and U-699. Captain Harger and I then cast off for the base in Antarctica. After rendezvousing with a supply ship and refueling, we continued the voyage, arriving at our destination in early June of 1945. The product of German engineering was a marvel to behold. A pilot came out and took the helm of the U-2015. We followed in her wake and were led into a large cavern that was invisible from a quarter of a mile at sea. A large dock facility carved out of ice, capable of handling several submarines and large cargo vessels, greeted our amazed eyes. Captain Harger and I were ordered to moor behind a military transport that was unloading disassembled aircraft.
"They flew aircraft from the base?" Little interrupted.
"The very latest in German aviation technology. Junkers 287 jet bombers converted into transports, fitted with skis, and specially modified for subarctic conditions. The slave labor had cut a large hangar in the ice, while heavy construction equipment had smoothed a mile-long runway. Over 5 years, an entire mountain of ice was hollowed out to form a small city, supporting 5,000 construction workers and slaves."
"Wouldn't the ice inside the caverns and tunnels begin to melt from the heat generated by that many men and their equipment?" asked Little.
"German scientists had developed a chemical coating
that could be sprayed on the ice walls that insulated and prevented them from melting. The heat inside the complex was maintained at a constant 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
If the war was over, Sandecker put to Hozafel, what useful purpose could the base serve?
The plan, as I understand it, was for the remaining elite Nazis of the old regime to operate secretly from the base, infiltrate into South America, and buy great tracts of land and many technical and manufacturing corporations. They also invested heavily in the new Germany and in the Asian countries, using the gold from their old national treasury, some of the looted treasures that were sold in America, and counterfeit American currency printed with genuine U.S. Treasury printing plates that were obtained by the Russians and captured by the Germans. Finances were not a problem to launch the Fourth Reich.
How long did you remain at the base? Asked Little.
2 months. Then I took my U-boat and crew and sailed to the Rio de la Plata River and surrendered to the local authorities.
An officer of the Argentine Navy came on board and directed me to continue toward the Mar de Plata naval base. I gave the order, my last one as an officer in the Kriegsmarine, before turning over a completely empty U-boat.
How long after the war ended did this take place?
1 week short of 4 months.
Then what happened?
My crew and I were detained until British and American intelligence agents arrived and interrogated us. We were questioned for 6 solid weeks before we were finally released and allowed to return home.
You and the crew, I assume, told Allied intelligence nothing.
Hozafel smiled. We had 3 weeks during the voyage from Antarctica to Argentina to rehearse our stories. They were a bit melodramatic, perhaps, but none of us broke, and the interrogation teams learned nothing. They were highly skeptical. But who could blame them? A German naval vessel vanishes for 4 months and then turns up, its commander claiming that he believed that any radio contact stating that Germany had surrendered was an Allied scheme to make him reveal his position. Not a plausible story, but one they could not break.
He paused and stared at the dying fire.
The U-699 was then turned over to the United States Navy and towed to their base at Norfolk, Virginia, where it was dismantled down to the last bolt and then scrapped.
And the U-2015? Sandecker probed.
I don't know. I never heard what happened to her and never saw Harger again.
You might be interested in knowing, said Sandecker, pleased, that the U-2015 was sunk only a few days ago by a U.S. nuclear sub in the Antarctic.
Hozafel's eyes narrowed. I've heard stories of German U-boat activity in the southern polar seas long after the war, but found no substance to them.
Because many of the highly advanced 21 and 22 class of U-boats are still listed as missing, said Little. We strongly suspect that a fleet of them was preserved by Nazi leadership for smuggling purposes during the years since the war.
I would have to admit you're probably correct.
Sandecker was about to speak when the phone rang again. He engaged the speaker, almost afraid of what he might hear.
Yes?
Just to confirm, came Pitt's voice, the pizza is on your doorstep, and the delivery boy is on his way back to the store through heavy rush-hour traffic.
Thank you for calling, said Sandecker.
There was no sense of relief in his voice.
I hope you call again when you get the urge for pizza.
I prefer calzone.
Sandecker closed the connection.
Well, he said wearily, they reached the aircraft and are in the air.
Then they're home free, said Little, suddenly buoyant.
Sandecker shook his head dejectedly.
When Dirk mentioned rush-hour traffic, he meant they were under attack by security force aircraft. I fear they have escaped the sharks, only to encounter the Barracuda.
Under its automatic guidance system, the Mahler Sky car ascended into the night and skimmed across the black waters of the fjord, slowly increasing its altitude as it swept over the glacier flowing down from the mountains. If anyone on board thought that once they reached the sky car, they had lifted off for a peaceful flight back to the Numa ship waiting off Punta Entrada, they were sadly mistaken. Not one, but four helicopter gunships rose from the deck of the Ulrich Wolf and set a course to intercept the sky car. One should have been enough, but the Wolfs sent out their entire fleet of security aircraft to stop the fleeing fugitives. There were no fancy formations, no tentative skirmishing. They came on abreast in a well-calculated deployment to cut off the sky car before it could reach the sanctuary of the mountains. Purchased by Destiny Enterprises from the Messerschmitt Bolko Corporation, the BO-105LS-7 helicopter was designed and built for the Federal German Army, primarily for ground support and paramilitary use. The aircraft chasing the sky car carried a crew of two, and mounted twin engines that gave it a maximum speed of 280 miles an hour. For firepower, it relied on a ventral-mounted, swiveling 20mm cannon. Giordino sat in the pilot seat this trip, with Pitt monitoring the instruments, while the women huddled in the cramped rear passenger seat. In a repeat performance of the incoming flight, there was little for Giordino to do but alter the throttle settings to maximum speed. Every other manipulation was computer-controlled and operated. Next to him, Pitt was studying the pursuing helicopters on the radar screen. "Why, oh, why can't those big bullies leave us alone?" Giordino moaned. "Looks like they sent the entire gang," said Pitt, eyeing the blips on the outer edge of the screen, which were closing in on the outline of the sky car in the center, as if it were a magnetic bullseye. "If they have heat-seeking missiles that fly in and through canyons," said Giordino, "they may prove a nuisance." "I don't think so. Civilian aircraft are rarely capable of carrying military missiles." "Can we lose them in the mountains?" "It will be a near thing," Pitt answered. "Their only hope is to take their best shot from half a mile before we're out of range. After that, we can outrun them. Their speed looks to be about 30 miles slower than ours." Giordino peered through the canopy. "We're coming off the glacier and entering the mountains. Twisting through the canyon should make it awkward for them to get off a clean shot."
"Shouldn't you be concentrating on flying this thing?" said Pat, staring uneasily at the mountains silhouetted in the faint moonlight that were beginning to rise up on both sides of the sky car. "Rather than chatting among yourselves?"
"How are you two getting on back there?" Pitt asked solicitously.
"This is like riding a roller coaster," said Megan excitedly.
Pat was more aware of the danger and not as enthusiastic as her daughter.
"I think I'll keep my eyes closed, thank you."
"We'll be thrown around by turbulence and the sudden shifts of direction through the mountains because we'll be running at maximum speed," explained Pitt. "But not to worry, the computer is flying the aircraft."
"How comforting," Pat muttered uneasily.
"The bad guys are coming over the summit at 9 o'clock, announced Giordino, warily staring at the glaring lights beamed by the helicopters that lit up the jagged mountain slopes. The pilots of the assault helicopters played a smart game. They made no attempt to chase the faster sky car through the hooks and crooks among the ravines that split the mountains. They realized they had one opportunity, and only one, to shoot down the strange-looking aircraft. They gained altitude as one and fired down into the ravine, their 20mm shells blasting through the dark in trajectories ahead of the sky car. Pitt instantly realized the tactic and elbowed Giordino's arm. "Take manual control," he snapped. "Stop us in midair and back up." Giordino obeyed and completed the maneuver almost before the words were out of Pitt's mouth. He switched off the computer control and took command, bringing the sky car to a gut-wrenching halt that threw them against their safety harnesses, then sending the aircraft back down the ravine in reverse.
"If we attempt to fly through that barrage," said Pitt, "we'll be shot to shreds."
"It's only a matter of seconds before they reposition and aim this way."
"That's the idea. I'm banking on them turning and deflecting their fire behind our path, expecting us to fly into it. But we shoot forward again, forcing them to realign, the same trick we pulled on the patrol boat. If things fall our way, we'll gain enough time to put a mountain between us before they can reconcentrate their fire again." As they spoke, the gunships broke out of formation to converge their fire. In a few seconds, they had realigned and zeroed in, firing directly at the sky car. It was the signal for Giordino to send the craft charging up the ravine again. The plan came within a hair of out-and-out success, but the seconds spent in reverse allowed the helicopters to move in closer. There was no concentrated barrage this time. The pilots reacted swiftly and began firing wildly at the rapidly fleeing sky car. Shells ripped into the vertical fins of the tail assembly. The landing wheels were shot off, and the upper part of the canopy suddenly shattered and flew off into the darkness, allowing a rush of cold air to flood into the cockpit. The murderous but inaccurate fire sprayed all around the craft, but mercifully the engines remained unscathed. Unable to evade the salvo by twisting the sky car obliquely, since the sides of the ravine were no more than 50 feet from the widest part of the aircraft, Giordino jerked it up and down instead. The 20-millimeter shells that missed chewed into the steep cliffs and threw up geysers of rocky fragments. Like a cat chased by a pack of dogs, Giordino hurled a sky car up the canyon in a frenzied series of undulating maneuvers. Another 200 yards, then 100, and suddenly Giordino threw the aircraft into a sharp 90-degree bank, skirting around a protruding rock-bound slope that blocked off the storm of shellfire. By the time the Destiny Enterprises gunships had reached the promontory and rounded it, the sky car had vanished deep into the blackness of the mountains.